five European Union member states called for a summit to discuss, quote, the huge disparities in the coronavirus vaccine rollout in the bloc. AstraZeneca vaccine is in short supply as the European Union takes a closer look at what's going on. And Bolivia's former interim president is arrested in connection with a 2019 political crisis that forced the then-president, Evo Morales, to resign and flee the country. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You're tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you all joining us. First story takes us to the EU this hour, where Austria, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Bulgaria, and Latvia have called for a European Union summit to discuss what they call the unfair distribution of the coronavirus vaccines. The five EU states have sent a letter to the bloc's top officials to complain about, quote, the huge disparities in vaccine handouts. They say deliveries of doses to member states are not being implemented on an equal basis. Now, the letter notes that under the current distribution system, only some nations would reach herd immunity. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has suggested that several EU states may have signed secret contracts with vaccine companies to receive more doses. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca has announced a fresh shortfall in vaccine shipments to the EU. The company has cited production problems and export restrictions for the shortfall. Jerome Hughes says the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in Europe has turned into a political crisis.
You have countries in Europe now, seven countries, in fact, that have either stopped using AstraZeneca altogether or restricted the use of AstraZeneca. And we're talking about Denmark, Norway, Austria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Luxembourg. So this is adding to the problems. Now, you mentioned the five countries that want a summit to discuss the problem. Yes, there are also issues there in terms of how these, which governments or which countries are getting the vaccines that they asked for, that they were promised. So there are issues there. That is legitimate that they want a summit. But the problem there, of course, is that, you know, they're under massive pressure now. And we've been covering these stories now for a year. And they're under massive pressure to try and get their act together, to get their heads around the vaccination strategy, the vaccination rollout. So, yes, they're calling for a summit and they're blaming the European Commission or they're blaming the pharmaceutical companies, but also they have to take some blame themselves. And so this is turning into a political issue. It's not just a social crisis. It's not just an economic crisis. It's not just a health crisis. It's now turning into a political crisis for these government leaders.
Meanwhile, Iran has reported 73 more coronavirus fatalities, raising the death toll to more than 61,000. The health ministry says more than 7,800 new infections have been registered since Thursday. That brings the overall caseload to over 1.7 million. 1.5 million people have managed to recover from the deadly disease. Iran implemented strict coronavirus measures in November of last year, which resulted in a decline in the number of deaths and infections. But the figures have been ascending since new cases of the UK variant were detected in several parts of the country. Investigations show that the Israeli regime is the prime suspect in a terrorist attack on an Iranian container ship in the Mediterranean Sea. A member of the technical team inspecting the damage to the vessel says the probability of Israel's involvement in the terrorist attack is very strong. The investigator cited the geographical location of the ship and the way it was targeted as the reasons for the finding. The inspector says explosive projectiles, possibly fired from a flying device, struck the ship's containers from above and caused the fire. The Iran Shah Court was attacked in international waters en route to Europe on Wednesday. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the act of sabotage is in clear violation of international law. It has vowed to take measures to identify the perpetrators. Iran's Guardian Council has rejected the general outlines of the government's draft state budget for the new Iranian fiscal year, which begins on March the 21st. This as the government had previously revised the draft bill following Parliament's rejection of the proposed budget. Yusuf Jandadi brings us more
After months of wrangling between the Iranian parliament and government over the outlines of this year's draft budget, the final budget bill is yet to be approved. In February, lawmakers dismissed the generalities of the budget bill after the government read the draft budget in parliament without the presence of President Hassan Rouhani. Parliament called the proposed budget bill too generous on government spending and short on development funds. In mid-February, the government amended the bill and sent it to Parliament. On Saturday, Iran's constitution watchdog, the Guardian Council, reviewed the new draft budget and sent it back to Parliament for further revisions.
One of the sticking points in the government's proposed budget has to do with its significant reliance on oil revenues. This as the country is planning to diversify its economy and steer it away from dependence on crude sales.
The budget of about $58 billion is up 22% compared to last year's figures, but way too low from the years before the most draconian U.S. sanctions ever targeted Iran's crude exports. The government had projected more than 2 million barrels of oil exports per day amid continuing U.S. sanctions, but lawmakers say this is too optimistic, given the fact that current crude sales are below 1 million barrels a day.
There are some ambiguities in the government's draft budget, including basing the budget on sheer projections of how much oil we will sell over the year. We're not certain about it, so what we did in the parliament was to regard 2 6-month periods. In the first period, if the projected oil income was made in the first half of the year, we will spend them mainly in the country's infrastructure. And if not, we will wait for the second half of the year to implement this part of the budget.
Parliament says it's now working on a list of the bill's shortcomings highlighted by the Guardian Council and will try to settle the issues with the government.
If the Guardian Council sends us the ultimate list of the bill's deficiencies, Parliament will review it within one working day and require the government to address those issues in the new amendment. I hope this will be finalized before the new fiscal year.
The government says any changes in the structure of the new budget bill could cause serious damages to people's livelihood. President Rouhani says the draft focuses on the nation's welfare based on the U.S.'s economic war against Iran, with infrastructure reforms, health, creating jobs, and boosting non-oil exports being among its key goals. Now, with just a few days to go for the start of the new fiscal year, the clock is ticking on the legislature and the executive to arrive at an agreement over the new budget. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Continue to other news this hour. Palestinians in Gaza have held a rally to mark the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day, paying homage to the victims of Israeli attacks, Israel's use of unconventional weapons during its wars and aggression have increased the number of injured among Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip rallied to mark the 53rd anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including women and children, with more than 11,000 people wounded. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars.
I was injured as a teenager and lost both of my legs, and there are thousands like me, especially children, who will suffer throughout their lives because of the Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have committed war crimes against us.
During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and some Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region. Hamas movement said normalization encourages the Israeli regime to commit more crimes against the Palestinians.
We condemn the United Arab Emirates for its normalization and support for the Zionist entity, especially its decision to make investments in the Zionist entity that perpetrates crimes against our people. On the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day, we stress that Israeli leaders must be held accountable for their war crimes and their crimes against humanity.
Israeli forces have injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters since March 30th, 2018, who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Wounded Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries.
Wounded people are living witnesses to Israeli war crimes. Every time I look at my amputated hand, I relive the honor of my injury. I blame Western countries, especially Britain, for my suffering.
Thousands of people in the Gaza Strip suffered from different disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons during Israeli wars and frequent military operations.
Israel's use of banned weapons increased the number of disabled Palestinians. Such weapons caused amputations of upper and lower limbs among innocent Palestinians during wars and during peaceful protests. We demand an immediate end to Israeli crimes.
Israel's callous disregard for human life continues to inflict pain and suffering on Palestinians.
Israeli forces have killed and maimed thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including women and children, since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
A British police officer has been charged with kidnapping and murdering a woman who disappeared in South London earlier this month. Wayne Cousins was charged after the body of 33-year-old Sarah Everett was recovered in Kent County on Friday. The officer serving in the Metropolitan Police Department was arrested earlier this week in the same county where he lives. Everett was last spotted on March the 3rd, walking home alone. Police say an investigation is still underway to find the details of the murder. Cousins is due to appear in a court to face charges on Saturday. While the case has sparked widespread anger about the safety of women, lawmakers have denounced gender violence and have paid tribute to more than 100 women killed over the past year in the UK. The United States has designated five Chinese technology companies, including Huawei and ZTE, as a threat to its national security. The Federal Communications Commission said the list is aimed at preventing the next generation networks from using services that can pose a risk to the security and safety of Americans. The designation came under a 2019 law that was enacted to protect U.S. communication networks. The law required the FCC to identify foreign companies potentially posing threats to national security. Firms like Huawei and ZTE had been blacklisted previously under the same law. Huawei had challenged a U.S. move in court but has now declined to comment on the new designation. Political commentator Andrew Leung says that Washington's deep-seated mistrust toward Beijing is due to its inability to bring China into a sphere of influence.
Previously, it was thought that China could be brought into the American sphere of influence, an American-dominated liberal order, and then by wooing China into the WTO or helping China into the WTO, then China would become more like the United States. And of course, this has completely fallen by the wayside. And now China is not seen to be not only not playing by American rules, but also threatening to eat Americans' lunch in high tech and so on, plus the security risk. And so this is started with by under Trump administration, but there is a bipartisan consensus, and that's why it's being carried on into the Biden administration. But the Biden administration, of course, would adopt a more principled and more selective kind of pushback. It doesn't mean that the Biden administration is going to be softer on China. The contrary may be the case. But then the Biden administration is going to target the key areas and is going to work more with allies.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Bolivia's former President Evo Morales has demanded punishment for those who orchestrated what he called a coup against his government in 2019. That after the former interim president was arrested on sedition charges. Morales says authors and accomplices of the dictatorship must be investigated and sanctioned. His comments came after Bolivian minister announced on social media the apprehension of Andes and several ex-officials by police. An arrest warrant was issued after prosecutors said Andes took part in a coup against Morales. The detainees face terrorism, sedition, and conspiracy charges. Andes, a former senator, took over as interim leader after Morales fled the country amid military pressure and violent protests against his re-election. Morales returned to Bolivia after his party won the election again last October. I'd like to welcome our guests to this news review. Isaac Vigio, academic journalist and commentator out of London. Thank you for being with us. Isaac, tell me about the significance of this, that actually the one who was part of the coup against Morales, now she's under arrest along with others.
Well, you have to understand that according to the Bolivian constitution, if the president resigns, it has to be he or she has to be replaced by the vice president or the chair of the Senate or the deputies. But what happened? The army demanded that Evo Morales left power, so it was a kind of a coup d'etat. And then there was a political vacuum. And Mrs. Áñez said that she is going to be the president, but she was not the chair of the Senate House or the deputy house, not even the vice president of any of these houses. And she decided to be president without the support of the Congress, of the National Assembly. So she was put in power by the army, by the police. And in the demonstration, when she was proclaimed as president, there were only 10, 20, 30 people. But the previous hours, there was a big demonstration of 10,000 people demanding that she should not take power because she's a racist. She said that the Indians should go outside the cities, that they have a diabolic religion. And she, in her first months of in government, she killed more people per day than the days have every calendar months. So she was like a military coup. She violated the constitution, and then she tried to persecute Evo Morales and many leaders of the socialist movement as terrorist, sedition, subversive, and everything. Now she has to be put in jail because she broke the constitution and she killed tens of innocent civilians with guns, and she has to be put in a trial.
Thanks so much for being with us on this news review, Isaac Vigio, academic journalist and commentator out of London. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
Russia is arming its naval forces in the Pacific region with a new advanced cruise missile that can sink ships. Russian-caliber cruise missiles fly at subsonic speeds whilst achieving supersonic speeds as they near their target. They're also capable of performing very high-angle, defensive, high-speed maneuvers, in contrast to the common linear flight path of other anti-ship cruise missiles. We present you an article written by Dave McKichuk. The piece is titled Russia's Caliber Missile Puts US on the Back Heel. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more of Dave McKichuk's article. It's a game changer. There's no other way of saying it, and it has been duly admitted by the US Defense Department, the Pentagon. According to a report in InsideDefense.com, Russia is now arming naval forces in the Pacific region with a new advanced cruise missile that will give its submarines and ships the ability to sink other ships and for the first time execute long-range strikes against land targets. Admiral Phil Davidson, head of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, told Congress in written testimony recently that Russia will begin fielding the Caliber cruise missile across its Pacific fleet this year, a weapon that other Pentagon officials have warned could be used to offset U.S. military power projection advantages and limit U.S. diplomatic options in a crisis. Admiral Phil Davidson said, "We expect the Russian Pacific Fleet will add its first caliber cruise missile-capable ships and submarines to its inventory in 2021, giving it substantially increased anti-ship capabilities and the ability to conduct long-range strikes against land targets for the first time." In a January report, the Defense Intelligence Ballistic Missile Analysis Committee assessed the range of the ship and sub-launch variant of the new Russian cruise missile, the 3M14 caliber, to be at least 2,500 kilometers. Inside Defense reported this kind of capability is prompting North American Aerospace Defense Command to think anew about domestic air defense, advancing the concept for strategic homeland integrated ecosystems for layered defense, or SHIELD. A recent Congressional Budget Office study, CBO study, National Cruise Missile Defense, Issues and Alternatives, examined the threat and determined a homeland cruise missile defense would be feasible but expensive, with costs ranging from roughly $75 billion to $465 billion over 20 years to cover the contiguous United States. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, noted that the domestic cruise missile defense umbrella could be overwhelmed by advanced threats like the Caliber. A raid consisting of many land attack cruise missiles could overwhelm them. For example, a Yasin-class guided missile submarine in the Russian Navy can reportedly carry up to 32 LACM or 3M14 caliber in its 8 vertical launchers. According to Inside Defense, Admiral Davidson said Russia is also modernizing forces in the Pacific region with an air defense and land-based anti-ship cruise missile, advanced fighters and upgraded bombers capable of delivering improved and longer-range strikes. Admiral Davidson added, "These improvements are designed to restrict access to regions of the Pacific Ocean near Russia's coast, while simultaneously expanding Russia's ability to project its power across the region and into the Arctic. According to the National Interest, there are well over a dozen different variants in the Kalibr missile family, varying in launch platform, range, target profile and speed, varying in length from 6 to 9 meters, but all packing a 990-pound warhead or a nuclear payload. The anti-ship variants designed, the SSN-27 Sizzler by NATO, or the 3M54T or 3M54K for the ship and submarine launch versions respectively, have shorter range estimated between 270 and 410 miles and are designed to skim low over the sea to avoid detection. Benefiting from vector thrust nozzles on the ship launch versions, the active radar homing caliber missiles are also designed to perform evasive maneuvers instead of making a straight line approach. As they close within short range of an enemy ship, the missile accelerates from their cruising speed of Mach 0.8 to Mach 3 and descend to just 4.6 meters in altitude, making them extremely difficult for a ship's anti-missile defenses to shoot down. The land attack variants, the 3M14T and 3M14K, NATO designation SSN-30A, appear to lack the boost to Mach 3 on terminal approach. In compensation, the inertia-guided missiles have a range of between 1,000 and 1,500 miles. A third class of caliber missile, the 91RT and 91RE, is used to deploy anti-submarine torpedoes to ranges of around 30 miles. The caliber is also a battle-tested and the result proved lethal. DefenseWorld.net reported that Russian Navy has hit various Daesh targets using caliber cruise missiles as terrorist hideouts on east of Palmyra that had housed heavy equipment and terrorist manpower. The Russian Defense Ministry said the extremist hideouts had housed heavy equipment transferred from Raqqa, the Daesh stronghold in northern Syria. Anton Lavrov, an independent military expert, said in an interview with Izvestia that high-precision cruise missiles are only owned by a few countries in the world, so the emergence of new calibers is a landmark in development of these missiles. Anton Lavrov added, "The strengths of the caliber are its high precision and the ability to hit well-protected objects, including control and air defense facility centers." Anton Lavrov concluded by saying, "The most important thing is the surprise effect. When there is an air raid, the enemy has time to react, but cruise missile strikes unexpectedly. In addition, caliber has an advantage. It can maneuver and hit the target from unexpected directions."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today.
The United States deployed the first naval ship to Eastern Africa in over a decade in what is a pointer to a new approach by the Joe Biden administration, which appears intent on using military power to pursue American imperialism in Africa. The expeditionary sea-based USS Herschel Woody Williams has been deployed along the eastern and Horn of Africa coastal region. Rear Admiral Jeffrey Spavey, the ship's captain, gives a hint here on Washington's new military strategy in Africa.
We look forward to working with the Kenyan Navy on future exercises such as Cutlass Express. Cutlass Express is a partnership building evolution where we will look to improve our maritime domain awareness. Our maritime domain awareness in conjunction with our regional maritime operations centers.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which brings you an in-depth analysis on events happening in Africa. In our program today, we are focusing on renewed American military adventurism in Africa. We are asking, what's Biden's military strategy in Africa? In the second part of our program, we shall update you on the Mauritius oil spill. In this regard, a top British multinational oil and gas company, BP, has been blamed for this disastrous oil spill, but refuses to take responsibility.
Biden's military strategy in Africa. Immediately after the November presidential election in the United States, high-ranking military officials from the country visited several African countries. The visit by these top Pentagon officials points to a new aggressive U.S. military strategy in Africa. Early January, General Jeffrey Harigian, the commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Africa, traveled to Camp Limonia in Djibouti. He later visited Tunisia and Algeria. During this tour, he met key defense leaders in the region. The visit was immediately followed by that of the head of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, to five East African nations.
Now, according to some reports, currently the U.S. has 7,000 military personnel on rotational deployment across Africa. These troops are reportedly in the continent to carry out joint operations with African forces against terrorists. However, many Africans are opposed to the U.S. military presence in the continent, as this Ghanaian here speaks out during a protest against U.S. military presence in her country.
I'm a mother, and we know what these Americans do. We know that these Americans has a lot of enemies. And by coming to settle their base here, we are not safe. And that's the reason why I have to join this campaign, to create awareness.
For more on the United States military strategy in Africa under a Joe Biden administration, we have contacted NAFTA Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Freeman. Now, we've seen that after Biden's victory, high-ranking U.S. military officials visited several African countries. Now, does this point to renewed militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa?
Yes, I think we can expect to see renewed militarization. Some of the things that the Trump administration did were adverse to the ruling class interest in the United States, the ruling class imperialist interest. They felt, the establishment felt, that Trump was neglecting their imperialist interest in Africa, doing things, for example, like pulling out troops on the ground in Somalia, or the also the Trump move to relocate the headquarters of AFRICOM, which has been placed in Stuttgart, Germany. They've actually put a halt on that and said that they're going to be revisiting this issue. They looked at the Trump administration, Trump himself looked at things like looking at America first and not really so interested or understanding the integral relationship that the exploitation of Africa had to do with the system he's trying to uphold. But now, since he's out of office, they're going to try to shore up some of those things and see if they can intensify the exploitation of the African continent.
Thanks for that, Mr. Freeman, an African-American peace activist. And stay tuned for more.
Over 8 years of Obama presidency, Africa saw an escalation of U.S. aerial campaigns, proxy warfare, and imperial competition. Somalia has been the key target for U.S. drone strikes that intensified under Trump's administration. During both Obama and Trump administrations, civilians bore the brunt of the attacks carried out by the U.S. military. What strategies will likely be pursued by the U.S. military under Biden in Africa? Can we expect to see similar policies pursued by Obama?
Yes, under Obama, the policy was to expand AFRICOM. When AFRICOM, the militarization of the continent, which is really the recolonization of the continent, United States wasn't able to get on the formal colonization, as it will, of Africa. But even after the independence movements during the 50s, 60s, 70s, the United States shored up and became actually the leading power in terms of neocolonialism on the continent. And under President Barack Obama, U.S. President Barack Obama, they were able to actually realize for AFRICOM, the establishment of their U.S. Africa Command, what they couldn't do when it was established under Bush, which was the proliferation of African lily pad bases and military-to-military relationships on the continent.
China is clearly the United States' main competitor in Africa. With the tensions between Washington and Beijing expected to rise during Biden's presidency, Africa could be a new battleground for these two world powers. Strategically located Djibouti is an example of the ongoing military contest between China and the U.S. in Africa. The Chinese government says its military base in Djibouti is meant to promote peace and stability in Africa.
Setting up the support base in Djibouti was a joint decision of the two countries. It will better let China fulfill its responsibilities in the international community and promote peace and stability in Africa and in the world.
The Senate confirmation hearing for Linda Thomas-Greenfield, Joe Biden's nominee to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, provided clues on Washington's aggressive policy to counter China in Africa.
China is a strategic adversary, and their actions threaten our security, they threaten our values, and they threaten our way of life. And they are a threat to their neighbors, and they are a threat across the globe. So I have no doubts in my mind about that. As I talk about that in the speech and referring to the Cold War, again, I'm referring to Africa.
Mr. Freeman, now do you think under Biden, Africa will turn into a theater for U.S.-China Cold War?
Yes, I think we're already seeing some of that. We saw some of that going before, and we definitely will see more of that. The United States is unable to compete with China in the terms of economic, the economic strength and its economic ingenuity. And so the only thing that the United States, in its unsustainable system of neoliberal capitalism, the only thing it has to resort to is militarism and war. And so, and militarism itself has become, a business, an industry itself. And so for them, the competition has to be a physical one because they can't compete economically in terms of how their system is designed. And so as a result of that, and the United States is not willing, there's no way that it's going to even consider, the ruling class in the United States is not going to consider cooperation, internationalist cooperation or internationalism. That's something outside of their purview.
Most parts of Africa have seen an increase of terrorist attacks despite the presence of Western forces, especially U.S. troops in the region, which claim to combat terrorism. U.S. troops have been operating in Africa for many years on the pretext of combating terrorism, but terrorist attacks have continued unabated in several parts of the continent.
Well, the studies have shown that not only have they've gone unabated, but they've actually increased. And any time you have colonial forces operating in a country, making that country unable to meet the needs of its people in any kind of way, you're aggravating a situation. Now, in Africa, they make sure that no real, genuine, revolutionary, socialist movements or governments can take root that will be able to be responsive to the needs of the people. So the people will resort to more reactionary forms of resistance, like with terrorism. And in fact, the terrorism on the continent of Africa, or the military operations on the continent of Africa, breed resentment, and people get killed, and their family members are died, and they join extremist groups. So, which actually all of this scenario actually helps serve the purpose of the U.S. presence on the continent of Africa, it gives them the excuse to continue their occupation and to super exploit Africa for its resources and labor and markets.
Mr. Freeman, as we wind up this interview, can you tell us what needs to be done by African people to combat imperialism and stop turning parts of the continent into U.S. military bases?
I think it's largely, or in a lot of ways rather, in a lot of ways not largely, the people on the ground have to organize, they have to realize the purpose of these forces in their countries. It's not for any kind of liberation, it's not to combat terrorism. They have to know that they're there for neo-colonial means. And what also has to happen, though, is that it's largely incumbent on population in the United States, people in the U.S., particularly people of African descent, that need to make those connections to stand up and call for a complete, unequivocal, unconditional shutdown of AFRICOM, withdrawal of all U.S. military presence on the continent of Africa. And so that has to, the call has to come and organize, and substantial call has to come from inside the United States, and those people calling for that in the United States and the people on the ground in Africa have to link up to make this cause, to strengthen it.
Mr. Freeman there says that masses in Africa must organize and demand the withdrawal of U.S. troops in Africa.
British Petroleum blamed for Mauritius oil spill.
Last August, a Japanese cargo ship MV Wakashio ran aground on a coral reef off the coast of Mauritius, leaking up to 1,000 tons of heavy oil into a pristine lagoon. A top British multinational oil and gas company has been blamed for this devastating oil spill. Recently released documents show that BP was behind the very low sulfur fuel used by the tanker. BP has also formally blocked an investigation into the fuel, which was reportedly known to be faulty from the moment the Japanese bulk carrier set off from Singapore.
As reported by Forbes, Japanese shipping giant Mitsui O.S.K. Lines had been aware that the very low sulfur fuel oil exceeded engine safety limits. BP issued a statement confirming that it supplied the oil used in the Wakashio. However, BP denied that the fuel was faulty. The environmental crisis unfolding in Mauritius is a stark reminder of the fragility of terrestrial marine ecosystems. Let's have a glimpse of just how the concerned Mauritians volunteered to clean the area damaged by the oil spill, which is near a popular tourism site environmentally protected area.
And that's what is nice with this pipe. It takes only oil, no water. The job is being done, and it will take time. The only thing that we need to just put in mind, it won't be done in a week. It's impossible.
The devastation of the Mauritius oil spill is yet to be fully addressed, while no major action has been taken to protect the island's waters from a future incident. Now, for more on the Mauritius oil spill and BP's rejection of responsibility, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a London-based African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Mbaluto. Now, British Petroleum BP has denied responsibility for the devastating oil spill in Mauritius, but the evidence appears incriminating. Where is the truth on this matter?
The ship carrying that particular oil arrived in Mauritius, and also BP acknowledges having the fuel, you know, selling it to that company, MOL, in Japan, that was to transport that oil. So it's the truth is a bit murky here, because there are denials, them denying it, but also investigations have not been carried properly, because also what it is, it seems like, you know, BP was trying to block the evidence. So there are things that are not really adding up. BP has denied. Legally, we can only say they denied. We cannot say they did it because they are denying, and perhaps it's a matter that is subject to more investigation in the future. But where we are right now, it doesn't add up that they are saying they have not done it, yet the evidence show a totally different story.
Thanks for that, Mr. Julius Mbaluto, African Affairs Analyst in London.
The Mauritius oil spill has been described as one of the worst ecological disasters ever to hit the Western Indian Ocean. Yet the Mauritian government, Japanese shipowner Nakashiki Shipping, and fuel supplier BP are withholding crucial information that could aid cleanup efforts and prevent future shipwrecks.
Mr. Mbaluto, you talked there about investigations. Now, what is the state of investigations on these matters, and is BP cooperating with authorities?
Where we are right now, BP has not allowed proper investigations to be conducted. There are allegations from document released through the Freedom of Information Act. And these documents incriminate BP. They're saying BP seems to have colluded, or probably IMO, which is the United Nations arm of shipping, arm of handling matters on the seas, rather. They seem to have known, actually, according to this document, they seem to have known that BP had this oil. So all these revelations have come through investigations, but they are not investigations that BP is cooperating. Number one, they tried to hide the truth by saying not responsible, but I think it was in January this year when they came across and acknowledged having sold this particular oil to MOL.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, you said there that BP is stonewalling investigations into the disaster in Mauritius. Why will they do this if they are innocent and have nothing to hide?
They will be quick, definitely, to deny responsibility. Why? Because the consequences are very stern. When you look into the things that go wrong because of disaster like this, effects are so much, and if Mauritius was to claim for compensation, and also when BP took responsibility, you'd be talking about health issues. Effects are touching on health of the people, the communities, because these are chemicals landed on the ground. They're gonna definitely affect people on the ground. We're talking about economic impact to their environment. We're talking about the well-being of the people.
So basically, what is clear is that BP is refusing to accept responsibility of the oil spill it caused in Mauritius to avoid paying compensation, which will probably run into billions of dollars.
Campaigners are critical of the very little compensation offered to affected communities. The government set up a Wakashiu solidarity grant for around 3,000 people, offering them a one-time pay out of 500. According to maritime law, the shipowner is responsible for damage caused by an oil spill. The Japanese government expressed commitment to mitigation efforts. How has the spill impacted on the fragile ecosystem of the affected area?
We're talking about economic impact to their environment. We're talking about the well-being of the people. We are talking about the biodiversity hotspots in Indian Ocean. When you look into this biodiversity, you are talking about the life in the sea itself, which is so critical.
The oil spill in Mauritius was also disastrous for local communities. These marginalized communities are expected to endure economic hardships and long-term health implications, which are already visible.
And that's like 2 weeks, my head, when I go to sleep, is like big head dash, you know? Like it's not only me, it's everywhere in the local people near coastal here. And the ice was burning also. I go see doctor for that.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, this pattern of Western oil multinationals shirking responsibilities, especially after destroying the environment, is repeated across Africa and beyond. Now, what needs to be done to hold to account these multinationals, which appear to be acting with impunity?
I think the best thing to do is to recognize the only body responsible to regulate maritime issues is IMO, and IMO, of course, is part of the United Nations. And therefore, when we talk about international territories, crisscrossing international territories, especially in maritime area, we are talking about a form of regulation that will correct all these wrongs and probably prepare the world for more preventive measures rather than reactive measures when things go wrong. So we are talking about we require serious major reforms within the International Maritime Organization, IMO. We require serious, reinforcement of the legislation that's already there. We require monitoring systems.
Well, thanks for your insight, Mr. Mbaluto. It's quite clear that international oil multinationals need to take responsibility by compensating communities affected by their recklessness and disregard for the environment. Now, thanks a lot, and on behalf of the entire Africa Today team, take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat Orbat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.